Hi everyone, this is Christy with the Illinois Radio Readers Group, and I will be reading from the Vermilion County News from the Commercial News for February the 14th, 2020. Our first article is Area Spellers to Face Off at Two Competitions. This is by Carol Rome. Junior high and middle school students from across Vermilion County will face off next week to see which team will be triumphant in spelling the most words correctly and advancing to the final competition. But first, student teams from each of the 10 participating schools will demonstrate their spelling abilities during two sectional competitions at 1 p.m., Tuesday, February the 18th. One contest will take place at Salt Fork South Junior High School and the other at Rossville Allen Grade School. Assistant Regional Superintendent Aaron Hurd said he was pleased with the number of schools participating in this year's countywide spelling contest. "We definitely want to get as many schools involved as possible and have an even number of them too," Hurd said. During the sectional competitions on Tuesday, teams of four students plus alternates from Armstrong Ellis, Bismarck Henning, Hoopston Area, Potomac, and Rossville Allen will compete against one another at Rossville Allen. Teams of four plus alternatives from Mary Miller Junior High School in Georgetown, Oakwood Junior High School, Salt Fork South Junior High School, Schlarman Academy, and Westville Junior High School also will face off in a separate competition on Tuesday at Salt Fork South in Jamaica. Each of the four spellers per school will be asked to spell 15 words during the sectional competition and at least 15 words during the spelling contest finals, Hurd said. The words the students are asked to spell come from a packet of approximately 3,000 words that the Vermilion County Regional Office of Education has had for years. The participating schools received the packet of words at the end of November so teachers could practice spelling the words with their students in the classroom. "We send out 32 different lists of words to the schools," Hurd said. "Within each of these lists, there are about 90 words on each one. With so many student lists and so many words, there is no way of knowing what words the students will be asked to spell during the contest. That's about 3,000 words, and they, the spellers, don't know which list will be selected at the meet," he said, explaining a drawing takes place to randomly select the word list that will be used. "Also, if a list has been used at the sectionals, it is not used at the finals," Hurd added. "As it ends up, the kids will need to know up to 3,000 words because they will have to spell every fifth word on a list during competition," he said. "The list starts out with easier words before transitioning to more difficult words by the end of the list, such as extraterrestrial, zealot, and interchangeable. They're words a junior high kid should be able to spell," Hurd said. "Many of the words are spelled differently than they sound. The top two school teams from each sectional competition will advance to the 2020 Spelling Contest Finals, sponsored by the Vermilion County Regional Office of Education, the Commercial News, and Danville Area College. The Spelling Contest Finals, which have been a tradition in the county for a long time, will start at 6:30 p.m. Thursday, February the 20th in room 306 of Vermilion Hall at DAC. This year, Mary Miller Junior High Principal John Tosh will be the spelling contestant's pronouncer. "He's got a good voice for the microphone," Hurd said of Tosh. "When it comes time for the spelling contest finals, the room at DAC is usually packed with supportive parents who attend the competition. We usually have close to 100 spectators," Hurd said. "It fills that room up pretty good." The top two school teams that have spelled the words most correctly will receive first and second place plaques for their school. Individual medallions also will be awarded to the students on the first and second place teams. Students on the third and fourth place teams will receive individual ribbons of participation. Last year, Hoopston's John Greer Grade School finished first, followed by Salt Fork South Junior High in second place, Oakwood Junior High coming in third, and Bismarck Henning Junior High School placed fourth. Our next article is Criminal Justice Reforms Take Shape by Peter Hancock. Advocates cite economic, racial disparities, prosecutors cite safety. This is from the Capital News in Springfield. Criminal justice reform is high on Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's agenda this year, but a legislative committee hearing Thursday in Chicago showed that reform advocates and the law enforcement community have widely differing views on the issue. In January, Pritzker said ending cash bond and mandatory minimum sentences would be among his top priorities during the 2020 session, and those two subjects were the focus on Thursday's hearing. For years, there has been a narrative that our cash bail system and the sentencing laws are necessary for public safety, and we support this narrative with billions of dollars each year, Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton said as the hearing began, but the stories we've heard call this narrative into question, and we must ask ourselves whether our current policies and practices are the best way to protect public safety. There are more than 38,000 people being held in Illinois state prisons, according to the Department of Corrections data. Of those, more than half are Black, even though African Americans make up only about 13% of the state's population. Many thousands more people are held in local jails while they await trial, often because they can't afford to post their bail. We know that over-incarceration based on poverty means that thousands remain in jail because of the lack of access to money, not because a judge has made a determination they are ineligible for release, said Sharon Mitchell of the Illinois Justice Project. We know that there's a massive transfer of dollars from communities that can barely take the hit, and we know the vast majority of people who are paying these bonds are not the folks that have been accused of the crimes, but women. In Cook County, it's very much Black women, mothers, sisters, and partners that are taking the financial hit of paying these bonds. One of these women, Brittany Williams, a 29-year-old mother of three from Chicago, said her life was turned upside down in October 2017 when her husband was arrested on a traffic charge. His bail was set at $100,000, meaning he needed to pay 10% or $10,000 to be released. This experience was traumatic because it took time away from my newborn and it caused me to get back to work before I was even ready, Williams said. We lost our condo in Glendale Heights and we had to move into the city of Chicago with a family member, my sister-in-law. That was hard on us because our living arrangements were not the best. Myself and my children had to sleep on the floor, and that alone made me feel like I had failed as a parent. Thursday's hearing, however, came on the same day the Chicago Tribune published a story calling into question the city of Chicago's own bail reform initiative that began in 2017. Under that program, which was ordered by Cook County Chief Judge Timothy Evans, judges in that circuit are not allowed to set bail amounts so high that a defendant can't afford to pay it. Evans released a report in May suggesting there had been no increase in violent crime since that order went into effect, and that only a very small fraction of people charged with violent crimes committed new crimes after they were released. But an analysis by the Trib uncovered flaws in both the data and the analysis used in that report, and the article said that there was evidence that many more crimes were committed by defendants while out on bail. Also, in 2017, the General Assembly passed a statewide bail reform law that provides for a presumption that most people charged with nonviolent crimes, known as Category B offenses, could be released on conditions that do not require cash bonds. It also provides that cash bonds can be required for more serious charges, Category A offenses, but that a person could not be held solely for an inability to pay that bond. DuPage County State's Attorney Robert Berlin testified that since that law went into effect, his county has seen an overall increase of 53% in defendants failing to appear for their court dates. Many of these cases are people charged with robbery, aggravated battery, aggravated DUI, serious crimes, where defendants are failing to show up in court. That is the sign of a broken system, Berland said. He also noted that under the Illinois Constitution, victims of crime have a right to be compensated for their injuries or losses, and that in many jurisdictions, bail money is used to help pay for that restitution. Without cash bail, he said, many victims could go uncompensated. The committees also heard testimony on the subject of mandatory minimum sentences, which many people argue have led to a dramatic increase in prison populations throughout the United States. The issue of crime has been weaponized in electoral politics, with members of both parties more than willing to attack opponents as being soft on crime and engage in fear-mongering in order to justify creating new offenses, increasing penalties for existing ones, and taking away opportunities for sentence reduction or parole, said Ben Ruddle, director of criminal justice policy for the ACLU of Illinois. Predictably, the result has been that prison populations have exploded in every state, including Illinois. Ruddle argued for doing away with mandatory minimum sentences entirely, but Representative Patrick Windhorst, Republic Metropolis, a former state's attorney in Massac County, argues that truth in sentencing has value for both the public and crime victims. I know that there's a lot of disagreement about truth in sentencing, and there are some stories that perhaps don't always paint it in the best light, Windhorst said. But I think for the public to understand what the person's sentence is important. And also, I think it's important for victims and families of crime that have a sentence is given, they can, in violent crime situations, understand that is what the person who's harmed my loved one or myself is going to receive. Thursday's hearings included members of two Senate committees and one House committee that will deal with criminal justice reform issues this session. Senator L.G. Sims, a Chicago Democrat who chairs the Criminal Law Committee, said it was the first in a series of hearings that will be held throughout the state. Our next article is Lending a Hand by Jennifer Bailey. This is from Danville. While home construction skills are new to some of the AmeriCorps members serving in the city for a few weeks, they say they are learning a life skill through each of their projects in Danville and elsewhere. Josh Krysik, 19, of Springfield, Missouri, was working in a bathroom in a Habitat home on Columbia Street earlier this week. He said after high school, he was trying to figure out what to do. He was looking at service projects and other programs and wanted to travel. He eventually wants to be a mountain guide and involved with search and rescue. The other team members come from California, Virginia, Texas, and other states. They've also had 8-week projects in New Hampshire, South Dakota, Kentucky, and Ohio. In Danville, they've been putting up drywall and working where needed on the house projects, Krysik said. It's cool to learn, he said, about these skills. Krysik said they've also been completing individual service projects such as the Eastern Illinois Food Bank's Foodmobile. Some of their free time has been spent at local eateries including Mad Goat Coffee and Charlotte's, he said. Team leader Amanda Williams, 24, of Mason, Ohio, was working outside earlier this week on a shed behind the Habitat home. She said she heard about AmeriCorps through a college speaker. Williams had been majoring in graphic design. Williams said the two words she used to describe her AmeriCorps experience so far is it's about an adventure. For example, she doesn't have much experience working with power tools. Williams said they don't really know what they'll be getting into next with their projects. They've had projects working with senior citizens and working in a cave. She said if students are interested in AmeriCorps, they should go into it with an open mind. You get out of it what you put into it, Williams said. The AmeriCorps NCCC, which is the National Civilian Community Corps, team started serving with Habitat for Humanity of Danville on January 31st and will be here through March the 11th. The team is helping with Habitat home rehabilitations of a couple houses and assisting at Habitat's restore with dock and other work such as unloading donated items. The AmeriCorps NCCC team of 10, four females and six males from the North Central Region campus in Vinton, Iowa, is performing activities such as flooring, window replacement, drywalling, mudding, interior painting, trim, ceilings, landscaping, and outdoor work as weather permits. Through their service, AmeriCorps NCCC members are helping area families. Families living in owner-occupied homes have increased stability in the areas of health, education, and finances when compared to renting a home. I'm super hyped to be supporting Habitat for Humanity, their mission to help improve homes and provide affordable housing for low-income families is something I believe is very important, said Tyler Sutter, AmeriCorps NCC member from Missouri, through a press release. Habitat for Humanity of Danville is a nonprofit organization that helps families build and improve places to call home. Habitat believes affordable housing plays a critical role in strong and stable communities. Habitat homeowners help build their homes alongside volunteers and pay an affordable mortgage. AmeriCorps NCCC and its FEMA Corps unit engages up to 2,200 young Americans in a full-time, 10-month commitment to service each year. AmeriCorps NCCC members address critical needs related to natural and other disasters, infrastructure improvement, environmental stewardship, and conservation and urban and rural development. FEMA Corps members are solely dedicated to disaster preparation, mitigation, response, and recovery work. The programs are administered by the Corporation for National and Community Service, which is CNCS. CNCS is a federal agency that engages millions of Americans in service through its AmeriCorps and Senior Corps programs and leads the nation's volunteering and service efforts. For more information, visit nationalservice.gov. An AmeriCorps National Civilian Corps team is serving with Habitat for Humanity of Danville through March the 11th. We'll now move to the obituaries. Kathy E. Gasper, Tilton, Illinois. Kathy E. Gasper, 67, of Tilton, passed away at 9:30 a.m. Tuesday, February the 11th, 2020, at Pleasant Meadow Senior Living, Chrisman, Illinois. In accordance with Kathy's wishes, a private burial alongside her father will be held at Oak Ridge Cemetery in Catlin. Christine Johnson, Georgetown. Christine Johnson, 61, of Georgetown, died Wednesday, February the 12th, 2020, in Georgetown. Funeral arrangements were incomplete in Rortvet Funeral Services, 3 South Hodge Street, Tilton. William A. Bill Boswell. William A. Bill Boswell, 63, of Danville, died at 4:37 p.m. Monday, February the 10th, 2020, at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana. Funeral mass for the Air Force veteran will be at 1 p.m. Monday at St. Paul Catholic Church, 1303 North Walnut Street, Danville. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday at David A. Phillips Municipal Building, 1001 Tilton Road, Tilton. Rortvet Funeral Services, 3 South Hodge Street, Tilton, is in charge of arrangements. Frida Cote from Lindar, Texas. Frida Cote, 100, of Lindar, Texas, formerly of Danville, died Wednesday, February the 12th, 2020, in Lindar, Texas. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Kruger Cone PAP Funeral Home and Crematorium, 10 East Williams Street, Danville. Wallace Wiley Wallace Wiley of 68 of Danville died at 12:18 p.m. Thursday, February the 13th, 2020, at home. Funeral arrangements were incomplete at Leek & Sons Funeral Home, 304 East William Street, Danville. Francis O. Barker. Francis O. Barker, 83, of rural Vetersburg, Indiana, passed away at 7:42 Central Standard Time Tuesday, February the 11th, 2020, at Carl Hospital in Urbana, Illinois. Funeral services will be at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time Saturday, February the 15th, at Dickerson Funeral Home in Vetersburg, with Pastor Bob Fairchild officiating. Visitation will begin at noon Eastern Standard Time Saturday at the funeral home and continue until the time of service. Burial will be at Cooper's Chapel Cemetery. Robert Cross. Robert Lee Cross, 73, of Danville, passed away peacefully at 6 a.m. February 5th, 2020, at Danville Care Center. A homegoing celebration will commence at 11 a.m. Saturday, February 15th, at New Life Church of Faith, 1419 North Bowman Avenue, Danville. Visitation will begin at 10 a.m. until time of service. Officiating pastor, Tommy Reed, interment, Spring Hill Cemetery. Connie R. Davis. Connie R. Davis, 73, of Danville, passed away at 2:43 p.m. Wednesday, February 12, 2020, at her home. A memorial celebration of Connie's life will be at 1 p.m. Sunday, February 16th, at Sunset Funeral Home and Cremation Center in Georgetown, 200 East West Street, Georgetown, Illinois, 61846. Visitation will be 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Sunday prior to the service at the funeral home. She was accorded cremation rites as per her wishes. She will be laid to rest in Crown Hill Cemetery. That appears to be the end of the obituaries. We will now move to the sports section. Blue Devils Advance by Marvin Holman. Maroa. The Mizbar-Kenning, Rossville, Alvin, and Oakwoods girls basketball teams battled for a regional title game spot. By the end of Thursday night's action, it was only the Blue Devils will battle for the IHSA Class 2A spot. IBRA defeated Monticello 37-25 in the first game of the night, overcoming a slow shooting night. I thought both teams were like the weather on offense, IHRA coach Mike Steffens said. Both teams didn't shoot the ball well, but we played good defense and we were able to get a little ahead. In the first quarter, Sophia Rome scored 9 of her 11 points to 5 the Blue Devils, a 13-3 lead, and in the fourth quarter, Emily Middle scored 11 of her game-high 19 points to put the stamp on the win. Riley Cash had 4 points for BHRA, while Serena Bryant added 3. In the second game, the Comets' season ended with a 50-47 loss to Unity. It was a good game, and we played good on both ends, Oakwood coach Stephanie Marsh said. We had a focus on number 22, Unity's Elise Cudson, and I thought we did good, but number 15, Maddie Reed, came on late, and they were able to win. The Rockets' defense was focused on one number, the 35 of Oakwood senior Caitlin Young. Young had 12 points in her final game in a Comet uniform, but Addie Wright picked things up with 15 points. We were used to everyone focusing on her, and it was great that Addie came in and stepped up for us, Marsh said. Alea Dennis, Aubrey Wells, and Carson Roop each had 6 points for the Comets, but with the season over, Marsh and the Comets will move on next season without Young, who is off to Murray State University. It was a good season. We had a goal of winning county, the conference, and a regional, and I was disappointed that we didn't get all 3, Marsh said. I thought we had a great year, and we have a lot of young players that have a lot to learn. The Blue Devils will take on the Rockets tonight at 7:30 p.m. Also at 7:30 tonight, Salt Fork will play Colfax Ridgeview in an IHSA 1A regional title game at Iroquois West High School. The game was postponed on Thursday. At Hoopston area, the Cornjerkers lost to Watsika 35-23 in a Class 2A regional final. Allie Watson had 11 points, while Addie Jones had 9 points, and Lexi Breimeyer added 3. In Class 1A, Milford lost to host Lexington 63-34. Kylie Warren had 16 points for the Bearcats. Also, Armstrong Potomac's Lily Jamison advanced in the three-point shootout. The following is an editorial from the Commercial News. Two ways to instantly crack down on public corruption in Illinois. Midwest Voices. If Springfield is serious about standing against corruption, it can take two important steps in that direction right now. It can release a hidden report that reportedly indicates serious wrongdoing by a legislature, and it can do away with a shameful system that allows lawmakers to cover up ethics complaints. Call it reform in real time. Editorials on Thursday. Former Acting Inspector General Julie Porter, who left the job in February 2019, told the Illinois Joint Commission on Ethics that the Legislative Ethics Commission squashed a report she wrote that uncovered alleged misdeeds by a lawyer. We still don't know what or who is in that report. Let's unpack that here. The whole point of having an independent legislative inspector general is to look into complaints of wrongdoing, no matter who the alleged culprit is. The IG is supposed to be an objective official to whom anyone can take a complaint about lawmakers who engage in transgressions. That's an excellent way to keep corruption from becoming entrenched. But as things work now, the Inspector General is required to take completed reports to the Legislative Ethics Commission, which is made up of 6 senators and representatives appointed by the legislative leadership. And this commission, though it is completely saturated in politics, can deep six any report on a whim. How's that for independent oversight? The commission can also pull the plug on opening an investigation and issuing subpoenas. It's all about protecting pals and insiders who have been up to no good. It is entirely backward, David Melton, Executive Director of Reform for Illinois, told us. Legislators don't want this office to do its job, and that deflects the whole purpose of having an oversight agency. What good is an investigation if the powers that be can bury the finding at will? The commission, in such instances, is nothing more than a government censor, hiding information from the public because it is politically embarrassing. Then state Representative David McSweeney, Republican from Palatine, said that this is like the fox watching the hen house. He's got it just right. The commission must be restructured, adding members who are not lawmakers behold to the legislative leaders. I think it is a big scandal, said McSweeney, who has introduced legislation that would require legislative IG reports to be made public. We have a sitting member who is accused of wrongdoing, and voters don't know who it is. It is a cover-up. While they're at it, the legislature should give the Inspector General the ability to open investigations and issue subpoenas without first having to get permission from the Legislative Ethics Commission. Moreover, as the laws are written, the IG has a much broader authority to investigate various types of transgressions than the commission has the authority to do anything about. The commission is restricted to acting on such misconduct as doing political work on state time, promising something of value in exchange for a political contribution, accepting certain positions after state employment ends, sexual harassment, and similar violations. That leaves a world of mischief that the IG might uncover, but for which the commission can't impose penalties such as fines. So, for example, if the IG gets a tip that the legislator is working for a company that's going to get a huge financial windfall as a result of a bill, the legislator is pushing the inspector general can check it out and write up a report, but there is no way for the commission to impose a punishment. And, of course, if the commission isn't pleased, the report will never see the light of day. That makes zero sense. The legislature should give the IG free rein to investigate and make the results known as warranted.